How many people have at this time quite a bit there in terms of the aftermath of the election for you, in terms of emotions, thoughts, and so forth? And so I was wondering about what to talk about this evening. And I consulted with some of the leadership of the Sangha and communicated with them. And the council was, in some ways, to address, you know, significant Dharma themes, but also to give some attention to the aftermath of the election. And so I'm going to do that, and it may not fit her work for everyone. That's possible. But I want to invite you to just stay with the process, and I think that there really can be ways that everyone can explore the territory of the different Dharma themes at this time in our Sangha life as well as our collective life. For myself, I actually have just come back from traveling. I ended my sabbatical, which lasted about 6 months, and worked further on the book that I've talked about on transforming the judgmental mind. Was able to have about 4 months of work out of the 6 months. About 2 months was really focused on, especially on taking care of my mother's house with my siblings and selling the house and finding homes for some of the possessions. And that was completed within a few months. And so I just traveled. I was in North Carolina, where I led a retreat. I was in Kentucky, where I led a retreat. And I actually was election night in Bernie Sanders' hometown. And I was looking forward to being at a party with him, but he was in California at the time. So it didn't work. But I also gave talks, one in Asheville, North Carolina, before the election, and two talks in Lexington and Louisville, Kentucky, that were after the election, and explored different themes and just kind of met people where they were. One of them was just 2 days after the election, and the other one was 6 days after the election. So what I thought of doing will have two parts. The first will be more interactive, and it'll be in the there'll be interactive practices which for me have been inspired by some of Joanna Macy's work, and very effective practices to help us explore some of the territory that's been opened up. And then in the second part, I'll give a talk, and then we'll have discussion, and I'll bring in some themes in part related to the election, or that can be related to the election. So, and this is, of course, welcoming any point of view, any perspective, not particularly geared to any one perspective. Okay. So, as I mentioned, this will have a significant movement component, which will start right now. I'll ask you to stand up and move into the space on either side of the chairs and behind the chairs.
Do we want to have our writing things with us?
No, the writing will come after we do a bunch of interactive exercises. So have your writing just at wherever you're sitting, okay? So right now, just let's imagine that you're at the end of the work week, if you're still working, or imagine the end of the work week if you once were working, and walk around kind of head down, not really seeing other people. So just keep walking around as if you're walking down the streets at the end of the work week. You kind of know there are other people, but not too well. Kind of in your own mind, predominantly. And now you actually have an insight. There actually are other people walking around with you. And you start noticing them. And now you actually come up to one person. And raise your hand if you don't have a person. We have, yeah. Looks like we have an even number. That's good. Everyone have a partner? Okay. And this time, just hold the other person's right hand. Hold right hands without speaking. You can look in the other person's eyes. Know that this is a fellow human being on our planet. And then, without words, in some way, thank the person and keep walking. And now you meet up with another person. And raise your hand if you don't have a partner now. Let's see. There we behind you. There we go. And this time I'd like you first to reflect on something that you love. Could be the way the light is in your kitchen, or your favorite place to walk, your favorite tree, something about your experience. Could be person, a nephew, a friend, name something. We'll have each person speak just for a minute, one at a time. Name something that you love. Take about a minute and then switch. So you should have switched by now. Let's have the second person finish up now. And when you're finished, thank the person in any way you like. And keep walking. Now find another person. Should be someone new. Raise your hand if you don't have someone. Oh, we have a little further exercise. If you don't know the name of the person, give your name now. Say hello. And this time, I'd like you each again to share for about a minute something for which you're grateful. So just reflect for a moment, something that you can describe briefly in a minute or so for which you're grateful. And then one person at a time, you can share. And now move to the second person, if you haven't already done that. Let the first person finish up. Now finishing up with the second person. And when you're done, in whatever way you'd like, thank your partner. And when you're ready, keep walking. Now find another person, someone new. And introduce yourself if you don't know this person. Now, if you can finish the introductions and go back into silence. I'd like you to invite you to look at the other person silently and know that this is a person who knows quite a bit about what is happening in our world. Who knows about the lack of empathy for many groups in society, who knows about the dangers of climate disruption? Who knows about racism? Who knows about economic inequality, both in this country and internationally? Who knows many of the challenges and dangers of our world? This is a person who is aware of much of what needs to be attended to. Now again, in whatever way you'd like, without words, thank your partner and keep walking. And meet up with another person, new, at least today. Raise your hand if you don't have a partner. Here we are. And this will be one that will take about 6 or 7 minutes. And we'll be talking to each other. So if you want to sit down, that would be just fine. On chairs or any other way. So you can be either standing or sitting. And again, we'll do this, giving each person a chance to speak. And what I'd like to ask you to reflect on is the nature of your experience since the election, what some of your thoughts and emotions have been, maybe more specifically, if you wish, where you are today, the last few days. And just reflect first, each person silently, on what you might like to share with this other person. And then I'll ask you to again, first introduce yourself if you haven't done so. And then have one person talk at a time for about 3 minutes. And then the other person can speak. And I'll time it. So I'll ring a bell after 3 minutes for you to shift. Okay? So let one person speak once you've introduced yourself. And then I'll ring a bell at 3 minutes. You don't have to take the whole 3 minutes. That's okay, but I'll ring the bell at 3 minutes to switch. Okay. about 15, 20 seconds. So finish up your thought. You can thank your partner. And then switch, about 3 minutes. About 15 or 20 seconds more. The second person finish up. Finish your thought. And then when you're done, thank the person in whatever way you'd like. And then return to where you were originally sitting. This is when we'll do our writing. So come back to your seat and then I'll give some instructions. And we'll do the writing in silence. So here are the instructions for the writing. I'll do it as well. We'll have about 6 or 7 minutes. And what I'd like you to do is to take a phrase as a starting point for spontaneous writing. And that phrase is, out of this difficult time, ... And you fill it in. And if those words don't work so well for you, Make up some others that work better for you. Okay? Out of this difficult time, and then complete it. Write for 6 or 7 minutes or whatever comes to you. Is that clear enough? Take about another minute or so. We're finishing up. So I'd like to say a few words myself, give a short talk and have some discussion. But first of all, I'd like to invite maybe two or three people to read what you wrote. If anyone would like to read, can use the microphone. Yeah. We have one, two. Let's just do those two. Okay, please. Yeah.
Out of this difficult time, I will take to heart the precept around right speech. To the best of my ability, I will not use language that is harsh or divisive. I will use my speech to seek out areas of commonality with others. I will look to see the fragile humanity in everyone, that somewhere, somehow, we are all protecting ourselves from our greatest fears. I will take the motivation to donate to organizations like the SPLC, who monitor and investigate incidences of hate crimes, racism, and bullying. I will take this energy awakened in me to become involved locally, getting to know my local government leaders as well as my representatives at the state and national level.
Thank you. And we'll have one more.
Out of this difficult time, I will reflect on how fortunate we are to be Americans and to live in a state that holds dear all the good values of our country. To not be deluded about the dangers that we face, but be grateful that I can do something. Support organizations that will work for freedom and justice and for our environment. To offer a safe place to anyone who might need it. To speak up and listen to those who don't agree with my views. To start a dialogue where possible. To try to keep grounded and to be watchful.
Thank you, and I think we probably profitably could have hear from everyone and have me not say a word, and that would be a very good evening. But I will say a few words. And again, I want to stress that the perspective that I'm having is that of really welcoming all perspectives. I'm not trying to enforce one perspective particularly, or even several, but really just to explore. I'll be exploring from my own perspective, and then we'll have some discussion time. I've been very influenced by some lines, particularly that I've heard from Tibetan tradition, which talk about the importance of having practice in all the parts of our lives. One is from the great yogi Shabkar, who lived in the latter part of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. He said very simply, let your life and practice be one. Let your life and practice be one. all the parts of one's life. They remind me of how we sometimes talk at retreats at the beginning. We say, all of you is welcome here. No part left out, right? And we welcome that. And I was also thinking of the Tibetan, kind of like a Dharma folk saying, and it goes like this. When the sun shines and my belly is full, I look like a Dharma practitioner. But it is when difficulties arise that my faults are exposed. You could phrase it in a little different way, but you get the point. And, you know, I'm also aware that really a main emphasis in the way Buddhist practice has developed in the West, not universally, but quite often, that the practice is especially for the benefit of the practitioners and for the development of people who can be more calm, more relaxed, more mindful, and more responsive in their lives, right? More skillful with speech. And the connection with bringing that practice into the larger world has sometimes been there for some people, but I think, largely speaking, not so much there. It's a generalization. I think that it's true. I think that the times that are coming will challenge that. Maybe you've had that thought as well. And I thought I'd read two passages that were written after the election. One of them is from a close friend of mine who is a writer named Marisa Handler. Does anyone know her writing? She's also a writing teacher. 28 years ago, my family left apartheid South Africa to come to this country, which appeared to us, in comparison, a bastion of freedom and justice. I am an immigrant, and I am profoundly grateful for the life and opportunities my adopted country has given me. And today this is written one day after the election. Today this, how can I be? Or how can it be? I am struggling to integrate what feels like a dystopian fiction. I am letting myself be stunned and grieving. I am taking the best care I can of myself and those I love. And I am reminding myself what I know in my bones to be true, that in order for genuine healing to come, the darkness must emerge. It must be seen and recognized and understood. It must, in as much as we are able, be loved before it can transform, before it can teach us what we need to know. I pray that I remain open and rooted in love and receptive to the immense teachings of this moment. I pray that we come together in love and strength. This is what we have been training for in both our individual healing and our communal healing. For times like these, my friends, there is a reason each of us is alive now, and there is meaning to the madness, and we have opportunity for ample purpose. As heartbreaking as this feels, as shaken as I am reminding myself this is a moment that ultimately serves to clarify, to awaken us, and that is a gift. And the second is from a Buddhist teacher, Zenju Erflin Manuel, who lives in Oakland. Anyone know her work? She wrote a book called The Path of Tenderness, former director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. She said, many of us have been practicing Buddhist teachings, we're walking a spiritual journey forever and preparing for every moment of our existence. We are ready and have been waiting for this time. Our rage, pain, and anger are to be exposed, if only for us to transform and mature with it. In Buddhist practice, we say, congratulations, because now is the time we have been practicing for. No more just practicing the dance. We must now dance. And this is not a dress rehearsal. So I have a few general thoughts, and then I wanted to talk particularly about one quality, which I think is very important now, and which is really a practice that can be, I think, at the center, or part of the center, of our practice going forward. So first I wanted to say that I think in many ways a bubble has burst. I don't know if you feel that yourself, but I had thought that at some point the bubble of a kind of normal society would burst. Maybe you did too. I thought it would come quite a few years down the road, maybe not too many, but that it would be primarily, it probably would be for ecological reasons. Something would get very apparent that we were in a real crisis point, and it would be there such that it was inescapable to recognize that. For some people, it's been that way for a while, right? For some people who follow particularly climate disruption, you know, the sense of crisis has been there for a while, but it's not there in the larger society. There's kind of a bubble of normality, of, you know, we're kind of moving along, we're doing a pretty good job, and, you know, yeah, there are problems, but basically, you know, I can live my life, right, in the bubble of, if one is in a privileged place, not everyone is, of course, but for many of us, I speak for myself as well, there's a kind of privileged place where things don't impact me in a big way. Of course, that's not true for a lot of people, especially outside our country, right? But for many of us, that may be the case. And I think this has burst that bubble. And it may not feel like that right now. And we're still in a kind of transition. But there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, we don't know what will happen. You know, we don't know what will happen socially. There are a lot of things that could happen that could lead to massive civil disobedience and social turmoil. You know, some of it could be related to climate issues. You know, if the new administration goes along with the Keystone XL pipeline, I wouldn't be surprised if there are a million or more people engaging in civil disobedience. And what happens if that's met with force, right? We don't know. It's possible, you know. I'm not trying to suggest scenarios which could be overly scary, but I think it's quite realistic. You know, what happens if large numbers of immigrants are rounded up? You know, very possible, you know. The person who is... I don't know if it's the person who's been named CIA director for the state of Kansas drew up a registry for Muslim people, right? And these are people who speak of what happened with the Japanese as not necessarily a bad thing, you know, in 1942, right? What happens if those things occur? How many of you would engage in civil disobedience? What would happen if that was, again, met with force? Things could open up quite intensely, right? You know, already you have 100 campuses saying we will be sanctuaries. I imagine that something similar will happen with spiritual communities. Maybe this one, maybe Marin Sangha, probably a large number of churches and synagogues in the Bay Area will make those choices, right? Maybe they will collaborate. Maybe Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, Confucian communities will join together. Maybe that's something that may happen with Marin Sangha that people want to do, right? That will change the nature of things. That, you know, it will open things up. So we don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty. You know, we don't know how the economy will go. You know? You know, talking with people who have more knowledge than I do, they speak of a lot of uncertainty. Maybe not immediately, but certainly down the road. What happens if there's an economic crisis of a major kind? Very possible, right? Not to mention foreign policy issues. So things are, I think, for me, likely to open up in unusual ways, in ways that are hard, in ways that would be very challenging, in ways that invite us to say, how do I respond? What does my practice tell me is appropriate response, right? Because remember, I think I sometimes have spoken of the core of our practice as being, we're mindful, we know what's happening internally, we also know what's happening externally. We know what our feelings and thoughts are. That tells us what's going on. And then on the basis of our best wisdom and compassion, we respond moment to moment. That's what our practice is. It's developing the ability to respond rather than react. That's the clearest, for me, and simplest expression of our practice. And I, as you know from some talks here, I like to use the phrase, we develop responsiveness rather than be reactive, as a very ordinary English, down-to-earth way to talk about the Four Noble Truths. You know, very, very simple. And so I think that this time is really calling for us to look. And I imagine a lot, you know, as we heard in the writing, I imagine many of you went somewhere similar. So I think we're called for our practice to continue to be very strong. There's a lot of uncertainty, right? A lot of uncertainty, a lot of not knowing. We have a lot of tools which are of tremendous value, you know, at this time. And I think we may be called to bring those tools into a larger setting. Or maybe some of us can train other people in mindfulness, you know, or in compassion, or in wise speech, or skillful action. So we can keep developing our mindfulness, learn how to be present to what's happening, to do that in the community, to see particularly, am I shooting the second arrow? Am I reacting to something difficult? That's going to be a core practice in this time, isn't it? Something difficult happens. Can I be responsive rather than reactive? Can I not just go into reactivity, complaining, judging, maybe even withdrawing? What's it take to be responsive? Can I have wisdom, a wisdom of seeing clearly what's happening in my own mind, in the minds of others, in the society? Seeing reactivity when it's happening in others, when it's happening socially. And I think there's particularly a place for the wise heart. And I want to talk especially about a quality which I think very central, because with maybe a certain amount of or a lot maybe of negativity or scapegoating that may occur, or even persecuting certain groups, right? With that happening, I think that there has to be an awakened force of the heart, an awakened force. And again, we're training in this. And I think particularly crucial is the quality of empathy. And I have been studying and practicing empathy and teaching about it some for quite a few years. I don't think I've taught about it here. Maybe a little bit. You know, maybe a little bit. And by empathy, I mean the capacity to tune in to another's experience. Very simple. And in the neurosciences, it's understood as occurring in three main ways. It's a natural innate capacity. I want to suggest that we can take this natural innate capacity and make it into a deliberate, intentional practice for ourselves and teach it as a parent, bring it into the schools, bring it into communities, bring it into this community, extend your own, and develop one's own empathy. So let me say a little bit about this, this quality. The neuroscientists say that it's an innate quality. It manifests in three main ways, and it's located in three different parts of the brain, particularly in the limbic system. Some of you know the neurosciences. And it's results in us being able innately to tune in to another person's feelings or emotions. That's one of the aspects of empathy. It also allows us to tune into another person's thinking or perspective. That's a second type of empathy. And a third is that it permits us to tune in somatically to someone's actions. The neuroscientists say that we have what are called mirror neurons. Probably many of you have heard of these. They must be wonderful to observe. You know, I have a sense that they're dancing or something when you look at them, because what they do is they sort of vibrate and connect. When someone else has an emotion, the mirror neurons are just going, yes, we're just tuning in that way. Same thing for all of these three dimensions. And yet, although empathy is a natural capacity, innate capacity, it can be shut down. And it can be, it can become, particularly for certain people, it can become dead. And we probably know that in ourselves and know that in others. What I'm suggesting is that empathy needs to be a deliberate practice that maybe is more central in our lives in the next years than it has been. I'd like to think of it as sort of a Western contribution to the wonderful collection of heart practices that we get from Buddhist practice, divine abodes of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And I have sometimes taught here on some other ones that we can add to that repertoire of heart practices, forgiveness, gratitude, and so forth. I think empathy is one of those. And it's particularly interesting because it can be an interpersonal practice and a social practice, that we deliberately develop and extend empathy. Because although empathy is innate, it can be overridden, and it's also not necessarily something which is always used for good purposes. A sociopath can be very empathic and use it for negative purposes, can actually tune in and know what people are feeling, but use that understanding negatively. So empathy in itself as a capacity isn't enough. We need to develop the empathy that's connected with compassion and with care and with wanting to help, right? Now, empathy gets overridden for all sorts of reasons, right? And you can probably think about a number of reasons it gets overridden. It can get overridden because of social conditioning. We are trained to perceive reality through having in-groups and out-groups, you know? And these are, you know, especially relevant in terms of ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, age, religion, and so forth, right? And what that conditioning does, it tends to make us much more empathic towards people in the in-group and less empathic and even, of course, less knowledgeable about people in the out-group, right? That's not something which in itself is something we can do much about. We were all conditioned in that way. This is what people call implicit bias. You know, and it's when implicit bias is connected with power, we have racism, we have sexism, we have homophobia, and so forth, right? But implicit bias can be corrected. And people are seeing that mindfulness is a main tool for correcting that implicit bias. And so we can deliberately be empathic towards people who are in the outgroups that we were conditioned to have. And so one of the forms of empathy is deliberately bringing empathy to groups that were originally outgroups for us. Again, we can may have some shame or guilt about that, but I think it's good to kind of get over that and really just move along. We can use mindfulness. One of the main things to do is just to multiply ways of connecting and knowing about other groups. So it could be a very deliberate strategy, individually and possibly as a sangha, maybe to connect with Muslim groups, Muslim people, Muslim friends, right? That would be part of empathy practice, to deliberately extend one's usual circle, right? Very significant. Read books, see films. Research shows that people who read imaginative literature have more empathy. Spend a little bit less time on electronic media. Research has shown that young people have less empathy proportional to their amount of time on electronic media. Kind of scary, actually. But research has shown that pretty clearly. So you can extend your circle of empathy, really. That's what's being called for. Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book several years ago called The Empathic Civilization. He said that empathy is the key quality that helps us to respond to the main systemic problems of our time. To have empathy beyond the usual boundaries. So we can do that. We can have friends who are in groups, social groups, that are not the usual ones we meet with. That's one way to develop empathy. We can, as a community, connect maybe with some of the groups that may be scapegoated further. We don't know what will happen. Muslims, Latinos, possibly gay and lesbian people. what other groups might be scapegoated? Yeah, Trump supporters may be scapegoated by some. You know, empathy, there was a lack of empathy towards Trump supporters, right? That's part of it. This is not selective empathy. I personally have not yet met and talked with someone who's a Trump supporter. Maybe like you, I'm in a bubble, right? I probably, you know, and that's part of the empathy as well. That's part of the group, right? So people who are threatened now, African Americans as well, right? So deliberately extend your circle of connection. Again, it could be done as a community. You can also, very beautiful practice to develop empathy is one I think we've done in the context of speech practice. This is my main empathy practice as kind of a meditative practice. It's to tune in to another person's emotions and what seems to matter. Do you remember doing that? Some of you do. As a practice, you know, so you can cultivate empathy with people in your circles, outside of your circles, deliberately tune in to that ability to be with someone else's emotions, be with what seems to matter for that person. Tune in to those two elements. You can do that now as you listen to me. You can tune in. I can be empathically met. And it feels good. Try that at work. Try that in your family. Deliberately tune in those two ways. It's a beautiful moment-to-moment empathy practice. You know, I think that's very crucial. This can be a lead for these times. And it connects very well with our meditative practice. So I'll finish. I could say a lot more. I have notes here. I could talk for another hour or two. But I want to have some sharing. And so let me finish maybe with a passage or two. Okay. I'll close with one from the novelist Eudora Welty. This was written a long time ago. This is really an empathy quote. "My continuing passion is to part a curtain, that invisible veil of indifference that falls between us and that blinds us to each other's presence, each other's wonder, each other's human plight. My continuing passion is to part a curtain, that invisible veil of indifference that falls between us and that blinds us to each other's presence, each other's wonder, each other's plight." So I'm suggesting you can lead with empathy practice, connect it with mindfulness, other heart practices, wisdom practices. It's a wonderful lead, both in general and in response to what's happening in our times. And if nothing bad happens, it's still a wonderful practice. Okay, so, thank you. So, let me invite any questions or responses, and then we'll, in a little while, we'll go to the meta cards. Please.
Would you please...
Let's use the microphone.
Okay. Would you please give us the name of the woman who was the writer that you read the first statement?
That's Marisa, Marisa. Handler, Handler. If anyone wants a writing teacher, she's very good. She's a friend, so it's a little bit of a friendly advertisement. Yeah, please, Mary, and then we can, and then.
The one thing I had found, and I know that Philip had talked about this, this is years ago, and for myself, empathy practice is really wonderful. And it, for me, it's almost sometimes it has the feeling sometimes of the compassion practice with the covering of the heart. But the one thing I know that for myself is that I have to ground myself in my own self, because I have to remember that that sadness is another person's sadness.
That's right.
And then I have to, so that even if I'm being empathetic, I have to recognize that it is actually, it's theirs.
That's great.
That's theirs. Yeah. And so my heart can open to it, but I need to let them have their sadness.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mary. I only talked about empathy practice for 10 minutes, so I left out a few things. But I think you're adding that, maybe that point, then one other occurred to me just to make very quickly. Empathy practice can be done skillfully. Some of us tune in well to others, and sometimes we have to keep boundaries and can be overwhelmed by being empathic. Some of us are very sensitive. And so there's a skill in being balanced with the empathy and also knowing what your own feelings are and being careful about being overwhelmed and losing your own perspective. So this is a typical phenomenon related to what's sometimes called compassion fatigue or burnout, right? People may lose their own perspective. So there are challenges with all this. We have to keep centered. Yeah, I wish I was talking next week. I could do part two. But and the other piece is that empathy is definitely to be connected with action as well. It's not a substitute for action. But I think naturally, if we have action as that responsiveness I was talking about earlier, as part of the picture, empathy can be directly linked with action. So I didn't say that, so I wanted to just name that as well.
Can you clarify? You said there were two things to do. develop empathy?
Yeah. I gave two broad ways to practice empathy. One was to extend the connections beyond one's usual circles, and particularly beyond what I was calling the in-group that one might have been brought up with. Again, around, you know, typically around some of the social hierarchies like race, gender, age, and so forth. And particularly in this situation, to make connections, again, it could be individually, it could be collectively, with communities that are more endangered or more threatened. Again, I think that's going to happen probably on a massive scale in the Bay Area. And I think spiritual or religious organizations are probably going to take the lead, is my guess, you know, as well as universities, which are already doing that, right? And so that's... And you can do that also by reading, by, you know, further developing friendships across certain boundaries. And, you know, or maybe they're there, maybe spending more time reading, film, all sorts of things. That's one way of developing empathy, is just to deliberately go against that in-group, out-group conditioning and be aware of how that conditioning surfaces. The second way is a more in-the-moment practice. Is that what you were asking about? It's to tune in when you're with another person to two aspects of that person's experience. First, the emotion, and then the sense of what matters, or the thinking, or the perspective of the person. And if you remember what the neuroscientists identified, that's tuning in deliberately to two of the three dimensions of empathy, the more cognitive and the more emotional. So that can be a regular practice. You're at a meeting, something, and it's a wonderful practice when there are divisions, when there's polarization. Practice empathy. It cuts through polarization. So I think let's do the meta cards now so we make sure we get that in. I mean, I'd like to finish on time. Art had a question. Should we do one more question and then the meta cards? Are you okay? So I see some people say yes. Okay.
So I this isn't really a question, it's more of a comment. I both really appreciated what you had to say this evening, and at the same time I had a challenge with one aspect.
Yeah.
And that was around, and this is something that I come up against in my own assumptions that I make in the
yeah.
world, is this... it seems like there was an assumption, where was the room for Trump supporters tonight in the room? Where was the space for them? And how do we do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't, we have to start to build bridges, and just because somebody's a Trump
yeah.
supporter doesn't mean they're a racist. At the same time as hate crimes escalated tremendously, particularly
right.
the day after the election, and there will likely be many people who will face serious challenge
right.
based
right, right.
on their ethnicity, mm. religion, sexual orientation.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. I would say there is room for Trump supporters in three aspects of what I was talking about tonight. Certainly any Trump supporters could have done the initial exercises and the writing. And I think I was deliberately trying to phrase that in a way which would be open to multiple perspectives. So I think they could have done that, and I gave room for rephrasing that last question or last writing, so it was... But, and then secondly, you know, I think the empathy that we want to have, this was brought out, we want to have for everyone. It's not... I mean, I think we want to have it for people who are, you know, endangered. I think that, you know, so for some of us that might be a priority, but we very much want to have it for the people who are experiencing pain, right? You know, there's a wonderful James Baldwin quote which says something like, once hate is gone, this is not saying that Trump supporters are hateful, some of them are, but even where there is hate, once hate is gone, people will need to deal with their pain. Baldwin was talking about that. So I would say there's an enormous, you know, we know that a large number of Trump supporters are not racist in some fundamental way, because a large number of them were supporters of Obama 4 years ago, right? And that might even be the key demographic, people who shifted from supporting Obama because they felt left out, I would say, by the elites and by the Democratic Party, right? And so one can certainly have empathy for their plight. And actually, again, I didn't have much time. What I think, you know, is very, you know, in my most hopeful of moments, I think that there actually could be room for quite a wonderful coalition across all sorts of boundaries that even have the potential of bringing in white working class, white people who have been left out. And I think to do that, there needs to, they need to have, they need to be empathically met, you know? And again, you know, at the same time that one criticizes certain manifestations, right? So in my hopeful moments, I think that there could be a coalition which could have the potential actually to reverse the whole history of racism, which, if you remember from the talks I gave in the fall, I interpret racism from the beginning, that is in the late 1600s, and primarily racism towards African Americans initially, as the creation by the elites of divisions between working people. I think you can make that case historically in Virginia in the 1600s. And I think I did that in some of my talks, that there was actually unity there, and division was sowed after a rebellion in which people joined together, right? And there were divisions and privileges given, and after that, slavery was tightened and so forth. So I think those divisions are, you know, to heal racism, those divisions need to be healed, right? I think so. I'm actually hopeful that empathy towards white working class people can be part of something quite amazing. That's ambitious, right? Does that make, I don't know if that makes sense as a scenario, but it's, I gave it, again, that's my reading of history. And that's a broad, I acknowledge that I do not have time to make that case well, but hopefully intuitively it might appeal to you that, you know, racism is based on having white people think that, or a certain number of white people think that their interest is not in joining with people who actually share a lot in common, particularly economically. So that's a longer response than I was going to give, but that, yeah, but thank you. I think that's crucial too. Empathy has to be universal. Yeah, thank you.